Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. My guest today spent 10 years researching and writing her debut novel, and it obviously paid off because she found not only an agent, but she also found a publisher. And she's joining us today to talk about The Henna Artist. The Henna Artist got off to a great start. It's got off to great reviews, and it was also chosen for Reese Witherspoon's book club. So how did all this happen for a debut novelist? Well, we're going to find out when we talk to Alka Joshi. She's a graduate of Stanford University and received an MFA from the California College of the Arts. She's worked as an advertising copywriter, a marketing consultant, and an illustrator. Alka was born in India, and her family came to the United States when she was 9 years old, and she now lives in California on the Monterey Peninsula. Her book, again, is called The Henna Artist, and here's my guest, Alka Joshi. Well, Alka Joshi, welcome to the show today.
Thank you so much, Vicki. It's so nice to be here.
Well, this is a very different book, and I'm looking forward to talking with you about it. But since we haven't chatted before, I'd like to share a little of your background with our listeners. You were born and raised in India, as I understand it, moved to the US when you were nine. What was that like as a nine-year-old? A very different culture, right?
Right. Extremely difficult because, let's see, we came from the desert, and the temperatures there will get to 110, 115. And we moved to Iowa, where my father was getting his doctorate. And it was early April when we arrived, and there was still snow on the ground, which we had never seen before. So you can imagine, first of all, it was the climate change. And then secondly, it was a huge cultural shift for us. So we were used to speaking English, but we spoke the Queen's English. We didn't speak American English. Mm. And I remember the kids pointed out, hey, the word is not schedule, it's schedule, you know? And so there were all these kinds of things. And we quickly, my two brothers and I, quickly adapted to the American English because, you know, as a kid, an immigrant kid especially, you never want to stand out. You just want to blend in so badly. You don't want people to single you out just because of the color of your skin or the name that they can't pronounce. And so, you know, we just wanted to blend in so badly. So immediately we picked up on the Americanisms and all the idioms, and we watched a lot of TV, Vicki. That's the best way for immigrant families to learn about a culture in a country.
Yes, I don't think people understand what a big shock it is to the system when you do move to a different country, because you'd think England and America are pretty similar, right? But I remember when I came here and I had worked until 11 o'clock at night on my first job. I was on my way home and I had to get pantyhose. It was one of those, I was a bank manager. I had to wear pantyhose. I remember going to the supermarket at midnight and thinking, oh my gosh, they don't recognize any of the names, or they didn't understand what I said, what I meant when I said I want like 10 denier. And it was just horrible. I was like, just give me a pair of pantyhose. So,
well,
yeah.
You know, in a similar way, when we arrived here, my mother understood English, but she didn't speak a lot of English. You know, she had gone, of course, to a school where everybody was taught English, but she had never spoken so much English. And so it became my job to go with her to the grocery store and to ask for things like cilantro, which, can you imagine, in the Midwest, in 1967, nobody had even heard of cilantro.
Oh, really? Wow. Yeah.
There were so many things. Turmeric. Nobody had ever heard of turmeric. So we had to, you know, shop around and find places where we could get the things that we needed for Indian food. But it became my job. And I called the phone company to get phones started. I would call the gas company. You know, all of those kinds of things landed on my shoulders, which meant that I grew up really fast.
Yes.
You know, in some ways, I grew up really fast.
Yes, yes, definitely. And you've worked as an ad copywriter. We have some lap over here. You've worked as an ad copywriter, marketing consultant, illustrator. So you've always written, but had you always wanted to write a novel?
No, that came as a complete surprise. In fact, I never thought of myself as a writer. So I went for my first advertising job, and I wanted to work in a big company. So I go to McCann Erickson. I got an interview there. I had not had an advertising degree, but, you know, I had taken enough classes to build a portfolio. So I'm on the seventh floor. I'm in these offices, these very lush, very nice offices. I'm being interviewed by two creative directors. They're looking at my portfolio, and they said, so what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be an art director. Because I always thought, since I was an artist, that I would end up being on the art side, you know, art director, commercial graphic person. Well, they looked at my portfolio and they said, we see a writer here. So we're going to hire you as a writer because, frankly, we need a junior copywriter. So I said, oh, well, okay. So I became a writer. And pretty soon, I loved advertising. I always loved advertising. And, you know, I told you we watched a lot of television as little kids coming to America. So I loved commercials. I loved jingles. I loved all of that. And so I took to it very naturally. I loved doing commercials and radio spots and print ads.
Yeah.
And so what I was really doing was writing tiny little stories. I didn't realize it at the time. 30-second stories, you know, a one-page story, a 15-second story. So I think it was a natural progression from that to doing a few short pieces about my life in India, which my husband encouraged me to write because he said, you know, you've got some really good stories. Why don't you put them down on paper?
Right.
So
right.
I did.
Right.
So I did. And then my husband said, you know, these are pretty good. And he should know because he graduated from the Stanford writing program and he is a writer himself. You know, he's a short story writer. And so I thought, okay, well, you know, I can't quit my day job. I had an advertising and marketing agency at that time that I myself had started that I had to run. So in the evenings, I started taking evening classes, workshops. And my teachers were so encouraging. Well, I still didn't think about becoming a full-time writer until the mortgage crash in 2008. And when that mortgage crash came and the economy tanked for everybody, my phone stopped ringing. And so my business phone was no longer providing any help in terms of income. So I thought, well, you know, I've got some money saved up. This is the best time for me to go to graduate school. So that's when I enrolled in an MFA program. For two solid years, I did nothing but talk about writing, read about writing, writing myself, and then, you know, being in workshops. And that was a great time. That was where I started the Henna Artist.
Right.
That
well,
was 10 years ago.
It's paid off. And I was going to say, this was 10 years in the making, you say, the book. But it's such a beautiful tribute to your mother. So let's talk a little bit about your mother, Alka. She sounds like an amazing woman. And I know, unfortunately, she didn't see the book come to be published, but I'm sure she knows about it somehow or another. So tell us a little bit about three things that you really keep in your heart about your mother.
Oh my gosh, there's so many things, but let me see if I can limit it to three. So one of the things I remember Mom was very adamant about is that I, as her daughter, would have the right to make all my life decisions on my own. She said, honey, marry whomever you want, marry when you want, have as many kids or don't have kids, whatever you want, it is your decision. Have whatever career you want. And she always made sure that I had those opportunities. She never once enforced her own ideas the way she had been raised, with all the boundaries that she had been raised within a very conservative Indian household. She never imposed those boundaries on me. That is the main thing that I remember about her. Number two was she wanted me to shine. So she said, I know that you're trying to be this American kid. I know that you don't want to stand out, but I want you to shine. I want you to get out there, get your name out there, get your face out there. You're a beautiful person. You get yourself out there. And, you know, it took me decades and decades to understand what she was trying to say and to come out of my shell, because I was very, very, very shy.
Right, right.
And I think a third thing that I remember about her is that she was so playful. She was so playful. Like, she could turn anything into a game. She could turn anything into a laugh. She had a great sense of humor.
Well, that's awesome. And I think sense of humor and that playfulness is imperative. And it's certainly that's something I carry from my mom, too, especially during these times, right, when everything's crazy. And, you know, sometimes laughter's the only cure for what's going on. But so your mom, I mean, she wanted all of this for you, and yet she herself entered an arranged marriage at the age of 18. She got three kids by the age of 22. So she never had those choices. And I think it's so special that she really wanted those choices for you.
Yes, absolutely. Because a lot of immigrant families want very much to hold their children close to their culture, to their language, to everything that they hold dear. Because I think it helps them feel like they are raising their kids in an environment that is familiar to them.
Right.
But my parents, and I have to say both of them were very different. Both of them were very different from other Indian people, because both of them wanted for us a life that allowed us to state our own opinions and to act on our own impulses. The only thing they asked of us, Vicki, is that we go get a great education at a great school, and all three of us did. And the other thing was, please don't have children until you have a career.
Right, right. So the henna artist, the story of the henna artist, is the life you say you imagined your mother might have lived. So tell us about the actual story of the henna artist and Lakshmi.
When we meet up with Lakshmi at the beginning of the novel, she is 30 years old. She has spent 13 years cultivating a profession. And she started as an herbalist, but then moved on to henna painting. And 13 years ago, she left an abusive husband, an arranged marriage that she had been in at the age of 15, because her parents could no longer afford to feed her, so they arranged a marriage for her. And at the age of 17, she had escaped that marriage. She had reemerged in a completely new city. And her ladies, the ladies that she serves, they assume that her husband has abandoned her, since she never talks about a husband or children. But she lets them think that, because for her in the 1950s to admit that she had left a marriage would have been so verboten. This is not something she could have revealed. So she walks this very fine line. She is of the Brahmin caste, which means that these ladies she serves are able to sit on the same divan with her in their homes. They allow her into their homes. She sits on the divan with them. They gossip with her. Because, of course, if you're going to have work done on you, just like with a masseuse or with a hairdresser, when you're with someone for over an hour, and they are touching you in a very intimate way, you tend to spill the beans. You know, you tend to get kind of personal and intimate with them.
Right, right.
So these ladies treat her as a confidant. Now, because she is a woman without a husband who seems to be present in her life and no children, they actually can treat her a little bit less than. So they treat her as a fallen Brahmin. And what that means is that she can also navigate the shores of the servant class. So she is able to straddle two very different worlds. And because of that, she knows about what's going on in every household. You know, the domestic help is friendly with her. She also knows what's happening between husbands and wives, because she serves those people. She's in a very unique place.
Right.
And she has built a business based on this role of confidant. She's an amazing businesswoman, and she also keeps the secrets of all these women close to her chest.
Yes, I can relate to that, because when I was a little kid, my grandparents had hairdressing salons, and I would hang out there when I was 5 years old and listen to what was going on. They do tell you a lot.
Right?
Yeah.
The women are so encouraged in that environment. There's something very intimate about it, and you just start talking about things you don't normally talk
right.
about. So when Lakshmi is privy to some of this information, what it means is that she can help these women realize their desires and their wishes in very subtle ways. Because she's an herbalist, she incorporates essential oils into her treatment of these women. She also incorporates foods that she feeds them while the henna paste is drying on their hands and feet. She will feed them these treats that have the kind of herbs and ingredients that are going to help them either get pregnant if they are not able to conceive. They're going to help them increase their libido or increase their husband's desire so that when their husband comes home, they will be, have an afternoon between the sheets kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So she has this ability to help these women, as I said, realize their wishes and dreams. And that's another reason why she's a very sought out henna artist.
Right. And I know you did a lot of research for this, even though you're from India and you left when you were 9, you did go back and do some traveling. But you had to do a lot of research. And one of the things, that period of time you're writing about was toward the end of the British Raj, that when things were starting to change. But I don't think people understand, if they are not familiar with Indian history, about the caste system there and how that impacts them in such a big way, and still does today, actually.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So what I wanted to write about, the novel takes place in 1955, 1956, and I think early into the 57. And what I wanted to write about was 8 years after independence, what does India look like? The Indians finally have their country back after 300 years of British rule and domination. And before that, there were many centuries of Mughal rule. India has been sought after by so many different countries because of the richness that the land offers and the crafts that it offers. So I wanted to write about the exuberance people were feeling about having their country back again to themselves. My dad was very influential in this regard because he was a young man at the time that Gandhi was really big and crying out for the Free India movement, the Quit India movement. And so he joined Gandhi's marches. He was very interested in Gandhi. And then as he became a young man and had to go to college, he joined the charge of Prime Minister Nehru, the first Prime Minister of India, to become an engineer. Prime Minister Nehru said to all the young men, become architects and become engineers because we need to build infrastructure in this country. So my father, at a very young age, was helping build the infrastructure of Rajasthan, dams, bridges, roads, buildings, everywhere. He was really influential in that space. And so he remembers how excited everyone felt. He totally got that. And so he relayed a lot of that information to me. And then my mother, of course, relayed a lot of this information about how the henna artists, when she was married in 1955, were not doing the intricate henna that we have Lakshmi doing in the book. That was purely from my imagination. What was really being done back then, because the Shudra caste, and you mentioned about the caste, Shudra caste people are allowed to touch the feet of other people. Feet are considered unclean in India.
Right.
And so the Shudra caste were the only women allowed to henna the feet. And their designs were very simple. They did designs that for weddings that were like dots and dashes and triangles, nothing really fancy, but that was what they needed to earn their income, and they did the minimal they could. What I wanted to imagine is a henna artist who could do so much more. I wanted to imagine a henna artist who could write stories of the women that she served on their hands, on their feet, on their bellies, on their backs, on their breasts. And that is what she's able to do. And so, Vicky, I am an artist first and foremost, right? I told you that now we're coming full circle.
Yeah.
I told you that initially I wanted to be an artist. And so for me to imagine what Lakshmi is painting on these women's bodies was so easy because my whole life I have drawn. So I could draw these things in my head that I'm having Lakshmi draw on their bodies. So that was so much fun for me, so much fun to just imagine how somebody could take a story and create a visual depiction of it.
Yes. And I want, what surprised you the most during your research? Because, you know, things have changed somewhat, but there's still a lot of the old traditions and fears. What surprised you the most when you were doing your research? Because you really did a ton of research on Ayurvedic medicine and you know, how henna and how that comes together and the history of that. So what surprised you the most?
Well, you know, what surprised me the most, I have to tell you, is something kind of personal. As I told you, all I wanted to do in the early years of being in America was to become an American. I didn't want to stand out. And I disavowed my Indian heritage. I didn't want to have anything to do with India. When I came here in 67 with my family, the only things that people knew about India were sacred cows on the streets, and then they would ask us about the women being burned on the pyre after their husbands died. And, you know, these kinds of things that me as a kid, you know, like as a kid, I didn't know about any of that kind of stuff. I didn't think about any of that kind of stuff. And I just thought, I don't want to be associated with that India. So for many years, many decades, I didn't even want for anybody to think I was Indian. Of course, my looks give me away, right? There's only so much you can hide. And so in doing the research and in going back with my mother, those early years of writing the book and going back to Jaipur and staying with her for months at a time and doing the interviews that I did and the research that I did, and then also going back with my mother to see her old school and her old principal and, you know, just all kinds of different wonderful experiences that I had, that just gave me such an understanding of where I come from. It gave me pride again in my birth nation, which I just cannot tell you how rewarding that is. I feel that it gave me a kind of peace and a reconciliation with my heritage that I don't think I could have gained otherwise.
Oh, that's interesting. I think a lot of the a lot of the heritage is really quite beautiful. I used to go to a school in England when Pakistan and England, all that was going on. We had a lot of people come into England right around my school. And I just was, I remember as a child, like just being blown away by all these beautiful saris, for example, and the bangles and the beads, and they always had their toenails polished. You mentioned feet earlier. But little things like that as a child are kind of stick in your memory. I kind of saw the glamorous side of it and thought it was really, really quite glamorous.
Yeah, I mean, and there is so much glamour, right? So this time when I was doing all this research and going back and forth to India, I thought, oh my gosh, how could I have disavowed this country that is so colorful, where no two women will wear the same sari, no two women, because there's so much variety in the fabrics and in the patterns, and there's so much scent. You know, there's sandalwood being incensed everywhere, and then there's there are flowers everywhere, and they give out these amazing tropical scents. There was so much to appreciate this last time, and I could only do it through the adult eyes. And because I was spending time with my mother,
right,
she was sharing things about her girlhood, I could see these things from her eyes. Like, we went to this one market one time, this outdoor vegetable market, and she said, oh, these are my favorite fruit. And I said, Mom, I've never seen that before. She said, these are called bale fruit, and they're tiny, and they only come out at this particular time, and I love them. You know, just little things like that, that I just thought, I'm getting to know my mother in a way that I have never known her before, right? Always
right.
Before, she was like my mom.
Right, and it probably answers questions that maybe you had about your mom. You know, why does she do that? Why does she think that way?
Exactly. You know, like, why you know, why did he raise me to be this person? It became so clear to me when we started going back to India together. I understood then how she is so restricted in that culture and how I don't even feel 1 ounce of restriction while I'm there. But she still felt it. You know, when she met up with her family, she still felt those things that you, that she was trained to feel, like, you know, why don't your kids speak Hindi anymore? You know, making her feel guilt and shame. There's so much of that that Indian women carry around with them because of how they're raised. And, you know, no woman deserves that. In The Henna Artist, I try to portray a lot of different kinds of women. I have women in there who want children, who don't want children, women who like the arranged marriage they're in, women who just want a love marriage, women who want a career, women who don't want a career. I want us all to appreciate that there are all different kinds of women, and we don't have to feel guilt or shame if we can't be the ideal woman, right? There is no reason why any of us should feel that way, and I think my mother felt very strongly that, that, you know, no woman should be shamed.
Well, yes, by the comments that you made a comment in something I read where your grandmother, I think, was feeding you and your brothers and she gave them more. And your mother said, no, in my household, my kids are equal. My daughters are equal to my sons. And, you know, that still is not true of all families in many different cultures, not just India. I mean, it's true in many different cultures. But did you set out with the idea of dedicating this to your mom, or did that kind of evolve as it came along, as the story came along and you did your research?
You know, it was always about my mother, because what I started off with was this germ of this idea, and I thought, what would my mom have done if her dad hadn't taken her out of college and said, I have arranged a marriage for you? What could my mom have done? Because while we were traveling together, you know, she would say, I was studying psychology and I love psychology. I wish I could have done that. I thought, wow, my mom could have been a psychologist. My mom could have had her own career. My mom never got to have her own career. And what kind of a person would she have become had she had her own career? How would I have been raised differently? You know, it just started this whole trigger of questions in my head. And so it always was about her, but then all the details came later in fictional form.
Yes, I can tell this is a work of passion for you. You sound so enthusiastic about it. I saw a video clip of you, and it was when you got, I think you got the call to say it was somebody wanted your book, you had sold the book, or you got an agent. I don't remember, to be quite honest. I saw it a couple of weeks back, but there was good news. This book was going to be published at some way. And you said you just sat there and your husband was all excited and you were just sitting there in shock. And now it's been chosen as Reese Witherspoon's for her book club. So, I mean, you know, what a way to start a debut novel. That's terrific.
Can you believe it? Just pinch me. I feel like I am still living in a dream. Some days I think I'm going to wake up and this has all been some kind of a strange dream.
Well, no. What did you... So as you're writing the story, did the story change as... You know, often we set out, once we've decided we're going to write something, and it changes, it morphs as it goes along, or it totally changes direction all by itself. Did that happen during the telling of this story?
Very much so. There were a lot of different twists and turns that I took that either were embellished upon because an editor said, oh yeah, you got to go deeper into this, or they were eliminated entirely. One of the first things I remember doing differently was my agent said to me, Alka, the way you've written this initial draft, you've got Lakshmi giving us one chapter in her first person. Then you've got Radha, her younger sister, giving us the next chapter in her first person. When you have two characters like that, you need to have them be equally compelling. And right now, Lakshmi is much stronger than Radha. And you have two choices. You can either get rid of the Radha chapters and tell the story through Lakshmi's eyes, or you can make Radha much more compelling. I tried, Vicky. I didn't want to change a thing, so I just tried to make Radha more compelling, and she just couldn't come out more compelling, because that was a much harder mindset for me to get into than Lakshmi, whom I identify with a lot more, and
right.
whom I really modeled after my mother. So I thought, okay, I finally got rid of all the Radha chapters. That was 140 pages gone,
wow.
cut, kaput,
wow.
you know, gone. So then I had to figure out how to get Radha's life into the first-person chapters of Lakshmi. So I started with page one all over again. This is one of the reasons why it took 10 years.
Well, it happens, and it happens to people who've written 20 novels and been very successful, and then on their 21st, they're like, okay, this is going in the trash.
But you know what? One thing I learned throughout this process is that writing a book is not an individual effort. It is a collaborative process.
Mm-hmm.
Every editor I've had, every workshop I took with a professor and then fellow students, even my agent, everybody has contributed to the depth of this book and made it the book that it is today. I have so many people to be grateful for to get to this point. And I'm so glad that it did take 10 years because I needed to listen to all those people. I didn't need to just wallow in my discomfort and depression, which frankly, you know, my husband found me many times on the floor like, oh God, I can't do this. And he said, no, just step away from the book, Alka, step away from the table, just go do something else. And I would take like 3 months off, 6 months off, whatever, from the book. And then finally, when I would go back to it, I would realize that I love these characters. I love this environment. I actually wanted to live in the environment that, you know, Lakshmi lives in. And so I would go back to writing the book and making those edits that people asked.
Well, very good. And I think those are good words for anyone to hear who is in the process of writing their first book, because, you know, there's a lot of people out there think it's easy to write, and it's not. It's not always. Sometimes it floods through you, and other times it has to be, you know, you go through heck. So I know listeners can find out much more about you at thehennaartist.com, and the book, of course, is called The Henna Artist. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Alka?
I want for every woman out there to know that she can reinvent herself, because I did that at the age of 51. That's when I started writing. And I also want every woman to know that she matters just the way she exists. She doesn't have to give an explanation for how she managed her life. She can be anything she wants, and that is perfectly fine. That's my mother's message to me, and I want that to be the message that women take away from this book. And a lot of readers do tell me that is the message they're getting, and they are starting their lives over again or reimagining a new life for themselves.
Well, I love it, and that's a perfect ending. Thank you, Alka Joshi, so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Vicky, for having me. I loved it.
And I just want to let listeners know again, you can find out more about Alka and her work at thehennaartist.com, and the book is called The Henna Artist. And if you have questions, comments, or feedback on today's show, you can reach me at conversationslive.net. We'll be back next week. Until then, stay safe, stay strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicky's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.